So, without further ado, this discussion today, our first discussion in this series, is focused on looking at an African monetary fund, or rather African-owned international financial institutions, and what difference those could make to the challenges that African countries are facing with regards to raising more finance, not just for COVID-19, but also for the sustainable development goals going forwards and general needs of poverty reduction and sustainable development. We want to look at this question, we've set this the provocative question, I guess, of whether an African monetary fund is a pipe dream or if it is a necessity. And to discuss that question, I have, and to set us off with this webinar series and launch it, I have three special guests to introduce today to you today. First, we have Dr. Donald Kabaruka, who is the former president of the African Development Bank, the former finance minister for Rwanda, and also the current chairman of Southbridge Group. He will be giving a opening speech for us. And unfortunately, he will have to leave almost immediately after that in order to attend very important African Union meetings. Of course, he's also one of the African Union finance envoys, special finance envoys. So of course, we're very pleased to have him here to open up, but also recognize he's got much to do as well. Taking off from Dr. Kabaruka will be, we'll have two extremely well-versed experts and leaders in their own fields for us. Mavis Owusu-Gyamfi, who is the Executive Vice President of the Africa Center for Economic Transformation, which is based in Ghana, and has played a very, very important role in the continent and continues to do that. Mavis brings to us over 20 years of development experience, including in particular with regards to private sector development, but also a great deal more. And we also have Hadiza Gagara Daga, who is the director for internal audit of the Ecobank in Niger, and has written extensively, researched extensively about an African monetary fund. So we're really pleased to have all three of our special guests with us today. So without further ado, may I ask Dr. Kabaruka, please could you kick off for us on this question, an African monetary fund? Before I do that, we have a little poll for our audience. My apologies. We were meant to just quickly understand a little bit more about whether the audience knows much about an African monetary fund. Could we ask the poll very quickly? So please just vote very quickly. How much do you know about an African monetary fund? So also help us as panelists and moderators to know what level to have this discussion at. Please submit your votes. Just 10 more seconds and then we'll see what the results are. Nothing, look forward to learning a little, but I want to know a little bit more, a lot. Looking forward to sharing my views. Okay, let's close it there, shall we? Great. Okay, so we have quite a lot to, looks like we've got our panelists are our most well-versed in this topic, and many want to know more, so that's perfect. So let's kick off. Dr. Kabaruka, please share with us your wise words and your experiences in terms of the future possibility of an African monetary fund.
Hannah, thank you very much. good morning, good afternoon, good evening, colleagues, wherever you are. I want to thank Hannah for getting us together and also to welcome colleagues Mavis and Hadiza, and to acknowledge what you're doing, Hannah, with your institute. I think the person who should have been here really on my platform should have been Beno Ndulu, who was a friend of mine, actually a classmate of mine, who passed away yesterday or 2 days ago in Dar es Salaam, a distinguished economist who has thought about these things when he was central bank governor, when he was in the World Bank and African Economic Research Consortium. So I ask all of you to remember him and his family in your thoughts. It's a big loss for all of us. I also want to apologize because I have to step out to talk about vaccines. And maybe this is a very good place to start. Why was the International Monetary Fund set up and the World Bank and GATT, the precursor of WTO, after World War II? It was because of the experience of the Great Depression, the 1930s, when international cooperation was at the minimum. Every country was running after its own interests. They called it beggar thy neighbor policy, whether it was in trade, financing, or money, competitive devaluations, and that kind of stuff. And then at some point, people came together and said, look, we're better off working together, whether it's about trade, development finance, or monetary cooperation. And all the institutions were set up. Of course, we as Africans were not there. So our interests were not reflected. It was a reflection of the winners of World War II. But never mind, never mind. The spirit that we can work together to prevent competitive policies which get us nowhere was useful. So today when I look at vaccines, they were literally today as we speak, in the 21st century, countries are running after their own interest on vaccines. Cooperation is at the zero level. Forget what we're reading in papers. For any country, even with money available, like many African countries, to get vaccines is a Herculean task. Because every country is running to try to get as much vaccine to save their people. And in this way, we shall not be able to vanquish COVID. If every country acts, my people first, instead of can work together. And that is a good way to start to think about this issue of whether need regional arrangements, whether it's African Monetary Fund, Asian Monetary Fund. They had one initiative they called the Chiang Mai Initiative in Southeast Asia after the 1997 Asian financial crisis. So do we need regional arrangements, global arrangements? There's things now we have to talk about. But we'll have to vanquish this COVID and then think about what it all means for multilateral cooperation. My sense is that it's a huge setback. And I say this with all the candor at my command, because when these institutions were set up, the World Bank, IMF, GATT, in 1945, they worked quite well for those countries up to the time of the dollar crisis in 1972 and the energy crisis in the 1970s. Then the wealthy countries came together to set up an informal arrangement known as G7. Which eventually became G7 plus one, G8, to try to figure out how to cooperate on currency or energy, that kind of stuff, which was an improvement, but the recognition that we needed to re-engineer these arrangements. But even that was not enough, because fast forward in 2008, during the global financial crisis, it was evident the G7 or G7 plus one or G8 was not enough. What to bring in the emerging markets, China, India, Indonesia, Brazil, South Africa in the G20. And it worked. It worked because it was ambitious, it was global, it was collective, and it was non-ideological. We have not fully resolved all the issues emanating from the global financial crisis, but we prevented damage to the global process. But now here we are 10 years later in the pandemic where we are completely caught unaware. gotten away with instruments which are not fit for purpose. And we're all struggling what to do. And when I say struggling what to do, it has two sides. There is a pandemic. Get the vaccines, get the testing kits, and cooperation there is, you can guess what it is. I mean, today, the head of WHO, Tedros, issued an alarm saying, look, rich countries are busy purchasing all the vaccines, and COVAX, poor countries are not able to get access to vaccines. So there is a pandemic. We have to resolve that. It has to be resolved because it can't be resolved in one country. It can't be resolved in the global north. It has to be resolved everywhere. So that's one side. But then there's the economic side, which I think is why we're here today, how do we handle this? So the North is rolling out huge amounts of stimulus packages, huge amounts, and absolutely unprecedented. And it is working. If you look at asset prices today, equity markets, look at commodity market, it seems to be working. The stimulus seems to be working. I hope it's not premature. But how about the global South? So we've been discussing since the month of March about what could be an equivalent in the South, which would be a special issuance and the reallocation of this liquidity instrument, which is a special drawing rights. We have not moved much. And yet, in 2009, during the global financial crisis, a decision then was taken to issue new SDRs going from 21 billion to 210 billion. Unprecedented. Of course, a lot of it went. So what would I have thought during this pandemic, the vaccines, testing kits, economic side would have a new measure of the education of that size. What we're asking for is something modest, 500 billion equivalent SDRs issue, allocate, so that it does not end up in the hands of those who don't need them. But we have not made movement for reasons which legal, technical, also to do with the politics in some of the large companies. And so we're hoping that with a new administration in the US, there could be some movement on a modest amount of SDRs, which costs rich countries only 0.5% of the difference of what they should be holding and all that are given away. Insignificant. So it's not a huge cost to the rich countries, but it will have huge impact on the stimulus of countries in the South. But that is political. We're working on it, especially envoys of the African Union, to make sure that we deal with the pandemic, has access to testing kits, vaccines, which is equitable, which is global. It's a task, it's hard. Forget to read newspapers about global solidarity. It is hard, it is difficult, because countries are looking for their own people first, and industrial capacity is limited. And our ability in Africa to manufacture vaccines is limited. We have only about, I think, four or five two in South Africa, one in Egypt, one I think in Morocco to manufacture vaccines. So we'll have to learn from this. In the future, we need probably to look at our manufacturing capabilities because depending on the global supply chains for this kind of emergencies, is showing serious limitations at a time when multilateral cooperation is seriously weakened. Now, why am I saying all this, Hannah? I'm saying this because let us not discuss African Monetary Fund, whether it is a pipe dream or reality, in isolation. It's about, A, can we actually re-engineer the 1945 organizations so that they work for all of us? Because if they did, we do not need regional arrangements. But if the global arrangements don't work, do we need now to begin to look at what I think it was Pascal Lamy who used the word, instead of multilateralism, he used plurilateralism. That is, rather than depending on some global institutions which should work for us all but don't work, should we think about the regional arrangements to try to security. Now, there are a lot of political, legal, technical issues to establish an African Monetary Fund or Arab Monetary Fund, Washington Monetary Fund. We're not there yet. I'm talking at the level of general principles of how do we do that and how it would work. Be that as may, the African Union has taken decisions some time back, I think 15 years ago, to create an African Monetary Fund, an African Central Bank, an African Investment Bank. So those things are decided upon already. The issue is how and when we make those things a reality. But I want to put them in the context of the crisis we're living today. It is important we think together. What does it mean when the global institutions on which we are supposed to depend in case there is a health crisis, a financial crisis, or a security crisis, or many others, don't work as they should? Should we then go back to beggar than neighbor of the 1930s, which we are doing now for vaccines? Technically speaking, vaccines should now be available for everybody, all right? No country should be able to say, vaccines are made in my country, therefore my people are first. After all, these are the rich countries which preach neoliberalism, free trade, no barriers, and all this. But today it is, hey, wait a minute, I'll vaccinate my people first. After that, we then put the vaccines on the market. All right? The 1930s. That's how the crisis of the 1930s was, so to speak, aggravated. We could have managed it, at least what we read from Russia. So I want to encourage you to debate these issues, but put them in context of what we are. The rest will be technical, legal arrangements, which I'm sure the competent people will be able to walk us through. So I'm afraid I'll have to leave, but Mavis and Hadiza know these things in and out. If I've spoken out of turn, I'm sure they'll be able to correct me and help us think this through. But we need to put this thing in the context of what we're living through now and how we can make this relevant for the people who will be watching your program. So thank you, Anna. Thank you very much for the opportunity. I apologize, I'll have to go. I wish I could stay with you, but thank you for what you do. And thank you, colleagues, for your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kabaruka, and all the best with the discussions on the vaccines with the African Union and others. Godspeed. So, Mavis and Hadiza, it's the three of us now to discuss and take off from Dr. Kabaruka's introduction there and his challenge to us to put these things in context and to make sure that what we're talking about is going to, in a sense, make a real difference. And it needs to make a difference. It absolutely does. This is the current challenge. So Mavis, I'm going to come to you first. In your perspective, Do you think that COVID-19 has uncovered a need for a regional institution? You know, as Dr. Kabaruka was saying, there has been work already done on African financial institutions, African Monetary Fund, Central Bank. Is there a need for one?
Thank you, Hannah. Before I answer your question, I just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge the passing of Professor Benno Ndulu, whom Dr. Kaburuka spoke about earlier on. I'm not sure if our colleagues in the audience know, but we had the incredible privilege of having Professor Ndulu as a board member of ASSET. So we acutely feel we acutely feel the loss that Africa is facing as yet an incredible great tree on the continent has fallen. So on behalf of all ASSET colleagues and our board, I'd like to just take this opportunity to say thank you to him for everything he did for us as a continent and as an organization, and also to say to his family that we hope that their memories of him during this very difficult time offers them some peace. So thank you for that. So going to COVID-19, has it covered the need for an African Monetary Fund? Hannah, I would say yes and no, in the sense that Africa has needed an African Monetary Fund for a while. I think the AU leaders were very sound in thinking about it 10, 15 years ago. COVID-19 happens to be the latest impetus. And the reason the continent needs an AMF is for two main reasons. One, it will enable the continent to have pooled funds that can be accessed by members under certain rules during difficult times. But beyond that, the surveillance role of a monetary fund will be critical for the continent. So let me start with the pooled resources. These resources would have been a valuable contribution to assist member countries to better respond to COVID-19 by supplementing resources such as those that they have received from the IMF thus far. But you know, in the past, during the Ebola crisis, other crises that the continent has faced, that pooled resource would have been incredibly useful. Now, the question here is, will member countries use the COVID-19 pandemic as a lesson to get together to build the AMF and to pool these resources that might be needed in bad times? So as Dr. Kaburuka said, you know, coming together has become even more critical today than we have seen in the past. So the question is that in that sense, I would say, yes, the COVID pandemic does indeed underscore the need for such an institution, but it's something that we needed before. And I just wanted to give the EU as an example. So the EU was triggered by the Second World War. And as part of that process, associated institutions around the European Union was set up. So the European Stability Mechanism, which then transformed into the European Monetary Fund, was created at the height of the European sovereign crisis in order to provide financial assistance to governments that had that time lost or were about to lose access to financial markets. The European Central Bank came out of that process in 1998. And if we look at what the European Central Bank is doing for Europe today, it has set up a 1.8 billion pandemic fund to help countries lower their borrowing costs and increase lending in the euro area, to keep borrowing affordable for members and ensure that they are increasing banks' capacity to lend and support credit for firms and households, and to preserve financial stability through international cooperation. So speaking on behalf of the members through the international global infrastructure. So having a pooled resource is one thing. Alongside that, the second thing is really thinking about the surveillance role that the AMF will play. Some African countries are often caught badly prepared to cope with shocks because their financial management is not as robust as it should be. So having a fund that has closer surveillance and provides peer pressure within African governments themselves, as opposed to just from external agencies, as such as we see with the IMF, is critical. Because it's very easy for countries to dismiss the IMF as outsiders' interference and for them to be seen as coming with unreasonable demands on countries. But if we had our own fund that is supported by the IMF, it would be an invaluable input to improving macroeconomic management within Africa. The critical point would be to ensure that we put in place an incentive structure that will give the surveillance role the gravitas that it requires. We need to ensure that there are robust indicators that will be adopted and will be used to calibrate access to the resources within the fund. And these indicators should be subject to performance and ensuring that the monitoring of what's happening in countries is really solid. So on those bases, I fundamentally believe that yes, we have challenges ahead. Yes, it would be great if we had a global system that was fit for 21st century development. We don't have it. The way we have seen the global system operate over the last 12 to 18 months begs the question, will it ever be there? And even if it is there, do we not need the fundamental structure to enable us to engage effectively? So the Niger has the same voice as South Africa does because we are working through a very strong united framework. I'll stop there for now.
Right. You will have seen me, but I'm not sure everyone else will have seen me, but I was nodding right through what you were saying and also, of course, nodding through what Dr. Kabaruka was saying previously. I think, you know, you've set out very clearly what the need is and how it could make a difference. I guess the question, and I'm going to pass this to Hadiza, is, and maybe you could explain a little bit more about even just how it would operate, perhaps even in comparison to some of the other regional organizations, as well as the, you know, Mavis has emphasized that the politics and the reason why these things happened. For the EU side, but what role have, for example, some of the other monetary funds for other regions played in dealing with debt challenges in the past?
Oh, thank you, Hannah. I would start by saying that when we work on our paper in 2019 with the Global Development Policy on the jumpstarting the African Monetary Fund, we were thinking about long term, and the paper was salient because it is just in the context of the crisis that we are talking now. So when we think about the actual context, the emerging market and the developing country are facing, we think that regional financial arrangement is a great example of what certain lead financial institutions can look like and the promise of them for the developing world. I'm talking about the example of the Latin American country, where they have the Latin American Reserve Fund that they are using now to support them in the financing and in the surveillance that Mavis was talking soon. So coming to the question, if an African monetary fund can solve African debt challenges? I would say no, not all the challenges that we are facing, but here is what it can do. You know, in economics, we are talking about competition. Economic competition, is the bedrock of developing alternatives, price setting, and so on. We only have, African countries have only the IMF when it comes on financing. But when the IMF is the only actor on the block, the important implication is that we have some person outside the country that is coming in our continent and telling our countries, here is what we need to do to get our fiscal house in order. They may not be worried about our health situation, our education outcome, The only thing that I worried about is fiscal outcome, how they can get back their money. The line here is that what the IMF does not provide, does provide country in time of crisis with in the best way to highlight, this is to point to an example, as I said earlier, to Latin American Reserve Fund. Colombia, which is the largest member, had a financial crisis, I think later 1997. And they went to the IMF and they didn't like the offer that IMF did to them. I mean, the conditionality, the term of the loan. So they didn't accept the offer. Why? Because they know that they have an alternative. So they wait for their turn to get financing from their regional funds. And they buy time to get a better deal with IMF, with the International Monetary Fund. So in some cases, one of the challenge and a lot of the time is debt rollover. So countries, they are rolling over their debt. It is not sustainable. It might be sustainable, but it is tight. And when a crisis hits, they cannot roll over it at all. That's why we saw in the Asian crisis, in a moment like that, it is really liquidity crisis. It is not debt sustainability. And in this case, a regional monetary fund can be a solution because it can help a country to buy time to roll over its debts. I might stop here.
That makes a lot of sense. So effectively, an African monetary fund would be able to be the lender of last resort for the region before the IMF becomes the lender of last resort for everybody, which is, you know, we have most regions have, of course, the world has the IMF now, which is, you know, Bretton Woods institution, but many regions have monetary funds. It's just the African region doesn't and stands out for that reason. And it can help certainly with the kinds of fiscal space, for instance, and the extra liquidity that is being needed, for instance, for the COVID-19. But I think it's really great that you've actually been very frank with us, that you said, well, to deal with full debt challenges may not be, but it could be, and especially in what Movis was talking about with the monitoring system as well, could be very helpful. So before we go to questions, and I also want to remind our audience, please do send in your questions. I know there's one in there already, so we will come to your questions, but as they arise, please share them. But before I do that, before we go to the audience, Mavis, how feasible is an African monetary fund? I mean, yes, other regions have done it. Yes, we have the African Continental Free Trade Agreement. Is there sufficient political momentum? Can there be sufficient political momentum? What is actually that's really required to make this happen? What can we even learn from the AFCFTA in that regard?
Thanks, Hannah. And I will begin by... I'll begin by going back to what Dr. Kaburuka said, which is, let's not say it's not possible. Let's look at what we need to do to make it feasible. So in terms of the challenges within Africa, it's really leadership. Do we have the leadership and buy-in to make an AMF work? If you look at the countries that have actually signed up to the potential of a single monetary union, which is seen as the first step towards an AMF, which I disagree with, by the way. Most of the countries that have signed up to it are actually Francophone countries that are already operating in some form of monetary union, either in West or Central Africa. We don't have that same level of commitment from Anglophone leaders that we have seen on the Francophone side. And if you look at some of the the whole agenda around concluding the ECOWAS common currency. You know, the process is not easy. There are a number of convergence criteria that need to be met. And trying to do this in just West Africa proved incredibly Herculean. Trying to do it across 55 heterogeneous African countries will be difficult. And it might actually be easier for us to think about interoperability of currencies as a more pragmatic way forward towards building an AMF rather than needing a single currency towards building an AMF. So I think if we could get over that first challenge of leadership and the steps to get into the AMF, we can make it a reality. The second challenge, which you asked, was, you know, are there any countries outside Africa who might oppose it? You know what, there'll always be naysayers, but if we had followed the naysayers, the Africa Continental Free Trade Area would never have happened. For me, what we need is the same way we had a leader who really drove through the Continental Free Trade Agreement when during his leadership of the AU, and that continuity by his successor was fundamental. So we need another strong African leader to kickstart the AMF journey and ensure the continuity. And it sounds like a broken record. You know, we always talk on the continent about the importance of continuity of policies at the national level. We need it at the continental level. We just need that continuity. And I think the AFCTA, from the president of Rwanda through to the president of South Africa as head of the AU, was so critical that if we can continue it, do something similar in the AMF, then it is possible to do it. Because when African leaders put their mind together, they can achieve it. We just have to see the incentives for that commitment to drive the change. I'll stop.
Yeah, I think that really is worth reflecting on in terms of where is that leadership coming from, and also the fact that, you know, there are all of the documents are there, right? All of the protocols have already been created. You know, this is not a technical issue. It is fundamentally, do countries really see their interests in this, and who is also willing to kind of go around and make those phone calls and visits and say, like, let's do this together. And I get, you know, that did happen with the African Continental Free Trade Agreement. Hadiza, I want to ask you, do you agree that the biggest issue is political? You know, you've been looking at the AMF, you've been tracking its progress for such a long time. Where do you think the biggest challenges are to making it a reality that is able to intervene in these sorts of times?
Well, I think that Mebin already highlighted it. The biggest challenge is, we can name the resource constraint. I'm taking just the example of the steering committee that started working toward the implementation of the IMF, and that stopped maybe 2 years later, because they didn't have enough financial support to continue the working they are doing. But I think now what we can do is that we can work remotely, and I think that it may not need as much biggest budget as before to start working toward this important project. You were asking if maybe country did not see benefits from having an monetary autonomy across the continent. But I think that more monetary autonomy allows country to have the space to meet their needs. I can, come back to the example of the Colombia that I was taking lately, because they had an alternative, and this alternative is a regional monetary fund. They can buy time to have a better deal with the IMF. But in the same time, Argentina, which was not part of the regional reserve fund, did not have the same opportunity as Colombia's, and Argentina were obliged to buy the deal offered by IMF. So as the crisis shows that African country needs a regional pool mechanism to provide liquidity, as mentioned earlier by Mavis, we also need the expertise and provide alternative option. So I think if we can sell this to EU leaders, to African leaders, I think that could be the political justification so that we can follow the steps that we describe in our policy paper, so that we can move toward the implementation of the funds. We can see that in the Arab Monetary Fund, we have a few countries on the continent that it does cover when you take Egypt, Sudan. So we have known that there is a need. They know that there is a need. This is why they are part of the Arab Monetary Fund. So why not having our fund on our continent? But most importantly, we all know that we are in dire need of money across the continent. And I think Dr. Kaburuka said it, we have the example that is going on the vaccine. And this crisis shows kind of the emphasis of the saliency to why we have to go toward the monetary fund. And
I think, and Mavis, do you want to say something straight away in that? Welcome to.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up very quickly on Hadiza's point, which is, the benefits of having that monetary autonomy. So as Hadiza said, we need liquidity to build back better. As a continent, we are going to need infrastructure, and we're going to need desperately needed jobs for our young people. If you look at the IMF, World Bank, African Development Bank projections, the pace at which we are going to rebound better is actually slower than the rest of the world. So even though a number of African countries have fared better than other we had initially envisaged, and also have not, we haven't seen the loss of growth at the pace in a handful of countries. Generally across the continent, the projection is we are going to grow a lot slower than the rest of the world is growing, which is the total opposite of what was happening in the pre-COVID era. So we really need that. We need that monetary autonomy to be able to invest in those things that matter really well. So things like infrastructure at the national level and across borders, thinking about the kind of regional public goods that will be required to make the continental free trade area work. As we always say, you need growth with depth. You need, countries need to diversify. We need better export promotion. We need increased productivity. Activity, better use and access to technology and human well-being. And if you look at the countries that have fared well, how you define faring well on the continent, is the countries that have actually diversified. They have done a much better job of diversifying their economies pre-COVID than other countries. They are exporting more than raw materials. Their productivity levels are higher than other countries, and they are using technology effectively and have really invested in the education and skills of their people. So that flexibility to make those choices cannot be underestimated as we look to build back better in what will be a long, slow growth process for the continent. I just wanted to build on what Hadiza had said.
Absolutely. And I think, the points you've both made in terms of the importance of having that autonomy to say, well, look, austerity isn't going to work at this point in time. And or it will work a bit later, but we need to do other things first, and to be able to have that range of options to do that is really crucial, and a monetary fund could offer that. Look, we've got six questions now from the audience, so I'm really, it's great, we've got lots of and really really useful excellent questions. I'm going to ask Khadiza, maybe there's a couple which I think you might best be focused on. Mavis and Khadiza also have a look at the questions, you might want to pick some specifically yourselves. But the first one is about community development financial institutions and how those have, whether there's any overlap in some way with the idea of an African Monetary Fund and what kind of role they might have. In the paper that Development Reimagined that we have released, we talk about the comparison between the African Monetary Fund and the African Development Bank, but we're talking more here, the question from Phil Chen is about community development finance institutions. I also think maybe Khadiza, you might be able to also take this question about any links to cryptocurrencies in an African Monetary Fund, if there could be any. And then perhaps we can look at this, and perhaps Khadiza, you can also talk about lessons from Jackie Bischoff, lessons from the multilateral institutions, what to avoid. It's a very good question, what to avoid in creating an African Monetary Fund. And then Mavis, perhaps you could also pick up on that. Khadiza?
Sorry, my mic was mute. Oh yeah, for the first question, what do you think community development financial institutions have currently or have into potential coincided local penetration with a hypothetical African Monetary Fund? I would say that the two will be complement. You are talking about the example of African Development Bank, which are mostly having a focus on the private sector, and the African Monetary Fund will work with state. So I would say that they are complementary. They are all together. Together we will have more benefits than having only one community development or only the African Monetary Fund. I don't know, Mavis, if you have something to add about it.
No, Khadiza, nothing at this stage. Please continue.
I think that I can move forward the next question before the cryptocurrency, when they were asking how to avoid the mistakes.
Yeah.
When implementing the African Monetary Fund, if you allow me, Mavis. I would say in the policy brief that we wrote, we kind of emphasize that we need to learn from other regional financial arrangements that are already in place and are working. If the steering committee is in place and they start engaging with this regional financial arrangement, we have I think around 11 regional financial arrangements, we can learn a lot and avoid the mistakes that they had made when they were implementing the regional financial arrangement. Regarding the cryptocurrency, we all know that this is where we are heading in the future. The most important thing to say here is to have a robust regulation. We need to have a robust regulation in order to have cryptocurrency.
Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking for that question in terms of having the opportunity to have harmonized regulation across the continent on that, which would be a useful function. Mavis, what do you think about this question about learning lessons from the past? And I'm also going to ask if you could also respond to the question on climate finance. I think that's a really useful one and really important.
Thank you very much, Hannah. So the first one on how we learn from other multilateral institutions, I think for me, the point that Dr. Kaburuka made about not assuming that these institutions are stuck in a time warp is really, really important. So whatever the impetus is to set off the AMF, it might be COVID-19, it might not be, because we never know. It might be something totally different. Whatever the impetus is to set off the AMF, we need to make sure that it really has the ability and flexibility to evolve and grow with the with what will be a rapidly changing continent over the next 50 years or so. So that having that written in the articles is really critical. And given the organization, the technical capability to make those adaptions is really critical. So that for me is lesson number one from what we've learned from other multilateral institutions. Lesson number two on what from what we've learned from other multilateral institutions is be careful not to withdraw when the rest of the world is on fire, which is what we've seen happen. You know, all the regional institutions have drawn, the large multilateral institutions that are meant to link out to the regional institutions and the country bodies are not able to do so because they have been built around a set of countries. So we really need to think about how we structure the AMF so that we are still able to engage with the rest of the world when there's crisis, both positive and negative, because I fundamentally believe that there will be a time where Africa will save the rest of the world like it has in the past. So we need to be ready to be able to play that role. So that for me is a second opportunity. The third opportunity is in terms of how the African Monetary Fund works with other Africa regional bodies. So one thing we learned from the multilateral institutions is they pretty much became silos. Okay. And then when there's a crisis, they all grapple to come together, and it's really too late by then. So if the African Monetary Fund is to be robust, it needs to do more what Europe has done, where the institutions are interlinked with all of its problems. I'm not saying the EU structures are perfect, but they are a lot more interlinked than we see in the multilateral system. So really ensure that however we build it up, they are interlinked with other African institutions. That is going to be really critical. So that would be my additions to Hadiza's point on the multilateral institutions. On climate finance, I think if we build a fund and we are looking at how to build the continent and grow the continent, we cannot not think about climate finance, and we cannot not think about sustainability. It's fundamental. However, there is a problem that we have right now. So if you look at most African finance ministers, from what I could hear a year ago, we're very open to sustainable financing, green growth, thinking about the climate challenge, really open to it. As the crisis has stretched out, as we haven't seen the 500 billion SDR come on stream, as they haven't had the support they were expecting to see from the international institution, and they are really grappling with liquidity crisis. They are really grappling with how they are going to build back better. They are really grappling with debt repayment in the short term, plus all the other critical financial investments that have been put on hold, investments in infrastructure, the investments in education, investments in health, all these critical things that have been put on hold. I think, and coupled with that, the current conversation around conditional financing for climate. So we will give you debt relief in exchange for green growth. All of that is sounding very negative to ministers of finance who are feeling we have an immediate crisis to fix, and we don't see we have so little room for maneuver. And now you are coming in with green climate conditions and green growth. And I think they are struggling to focus on it. So an AMF will help, but I think the conversation on climate in the run-up to COP really needs to take into consideration what countries are grappling with right now in the continent in the short term. Green growth matters to Africa. We're not going to walk away. I know that in terms of our footprint, you know, we are negative. We have lots of opportunities going forward. But right now, I don't think many ministers of finance have the headspace. And we've got to, you know, there is, I'd almost call on the climate community to ask the rest of the financing community to help ministers of finance on the continent with the SDR and other challenges they are facing, so that they will have the headspace to jump on that critical conversation that is happening in the run-up to COP. Hannah.
Right. So if an African Monetary Fund could play a role, in a sense, it's to kind of reduce some of the need for countries to be worrying so much and being kind of taken off the path, in a sense, towards green growth as they commit to that. And of course, you know, there are countries that have on the continent even committed to things like carbon neutrality. They have. It's more a case of, can they actually deal with it right now? And I think that that's absolutely fair. But yeah, certainly, maybe if it was in the mix, and perhaps one of the issues is that the African continent is relying too much on certain organizations or certain institutions to solve everything, rather than saying, well, okay, this is the institution we go to for this issue, we go to that institution for another, and you eventually develop a sense of specialism as you build up. Okay, Khadiza, I think I've got a couple more questions for you. I hope, Selena, that answers your question. I think it's a very good one, very useful to be able to talk through that. Selena, we have a question for Khadiza. We have a question from Alistair Scott. Is the biggest challenge of creating a fund, making it a reality, ideological, or is it technical and financial? And it's coming back to those questions. And I think the specific question here is a very interesting one of, is it transparency and accountability that's necessary? Is that a stumbling block, or is it just that it's just not ready? People just aren't ready. What do you think, Khadiza?
I think that the challenge is, maybe outlined it at the beginning about the resources. But yes, we may face a technical challenge as well. This is why I'm coming back again to the re-implementation of the steering committee, who can work and draw a lesson from other, but also try to kind of see all the technical issue that we may facing going forward to the implementation of the fund. So yes, we may face, and I think that even other region, when they were implementing their fund, they face a technical issue, but I'm sure that we have the resources on the continent to do so. So we should leverage on the resources that we have, that they are even working outside the continent. We can have them back and work on the project. I think I can move to the next question, if you allow me, Hannah. I think that I saw a question regarding the growth of the continent, regarding the youngest working age that we have. Maybe say, allow me, maybe this best suits you. But I think that we should take our youngest working age as an opportunity. If we give to our youngest age good education, a great asset for them to create an enterprise, I think this is what is going to help us, because we all know that the creation of enterprise is the backbone of all economy. And if we give them the asset to do so, I think that our growth will be positive in the future.
Fully agree with that, Khadiza. Mavis, do you want to also tackle that question? And also, someone has asked you, John Osei has asked you whether you the question about the operability, currency operability, interoperability, how might that help deal with the liquidity challenges? Could you explain that a little bit more from our audience?
Thanks, Hannah. So I'll just build on the point that Hadiza made on our young population. So if you look at some of the challenges that we are seeing in a post-COVID world is on the continent is increased levels of unemployment, increased levels of underemployment. But even pre-COVID, we had a real disconnect between the number of young people entering working age population and the availability of jobs. I don't have the statistics at hand, but I think the assumption was Africa needed to create 3 million jobs per annum to meet that market, and it's currently creating a couple of 100,000. So there is a real disconnect. But even where it is creating jobs, we are seeing a disconnect between demand for skills and supply for skills. So even where our young people are investing in their skills, they are not necessarily leaving education or secondary or training institutions with the skills that the market requires. So there's a real disconnect and a lot of work to be done around skills development to meet the evolving nature of work on the continent so that we can really make sure that whatever jobs are grown with investments adds to the employment. And I'm not talking about people becoming Uber drivers. That is not a decent job. An Uber driver does not earn enough to pay their rent and eat and live on the continent. We use it, Ubers, but we know it does not work. So we need to really think through, when we talk about jobs, we talk about decent jobs on the continent. So the way I think an AMF will help this is if you look at what the European Investment Bank is doing, the European Central Bank is doing, it is giving banks the flexibility and the ability to lend, continue to lend at low interest rates during this crisis. Okay, and all of our banks on the continent are struggling. Central banks across the continent are trying to ease the pressure on banks and encourage banks to lend to SMEs. Governments are directly lending to SMEs. But if we had an AMF, there would be a second tier of support. And all of these great innovations that we have seen in the post-COVID era could actually become future companies. I mean, it's my biggest bugbear at the moment. What's going to happen to those entrepreneurs that we are celebrating during this COVID era? Are we going to be able to help them grow and become real future job creators? A lot depends on access to finance as well as other skills. So that was my first point. My second point on to John. So John, just to be clear, I don't see the interoperability as necessarily solving our liquidity challenge. If you look at the current protocols in building the African Monetary Fund, there seems to be a sense that we need an African Monetary Union before we can get to an Africa Monetary Fund. And what I was saying was, it might not be necessary for us to have an African Monetary Union because the convergence of 55, well, it'll be less than 55 currencies because you have the Francophone currencies, will be harder than if we looked at how we make the currencies work with each other and then a move to an AMF. So we don't necessarily need a single currency and a single union to be able to move to the AMF. That's what I meant by that.
Great, thank you, thank you. Now, I'm going to, we've got one more question that's just come in right at the end. From Dr. K.Y. Amoako, what the threats are to creating an African Monetary Fund. And I think, you know, perhaps we can wrap this up almost with my last question to you, both Khadiza and Mavis, which is, you know, if you were going to be advising African leaders now, what to do with an African Monetary Fund, how would you suggest they proceed and how would they, you know, how would they deal with the threats? How can they become ready to support this idea. Hadiza, would you like to kick off on that one? This will be the last question, and then we'll wrap up.
Thank you, Hannah. I think if I were to give any advice on how we should proceed going forward, I will say that we also see that this crisis shows that we need the regional pool, and this is what we have to sell. I mean, we don't even have to sell it because they already know about it to our leaders. We have the political justification of the creation of the fund. What we can do is to give the minimum resources to the people who can work on the committee and sign and ratify the protocol that they created in 1994, and come up with a timetable to pledge to capitalize and give each country sometimes maybe three to five years going forward to adjust to the crisis. But we can simultaneously work with other region and engage with the network that has already been created in the global systems. And later on, we can engage with IMF. Talking about the threat, maybe before I may say that the global financial institutions might not see it with a good eye, the creation of regional monetary fund. And they were talking about moral hazard that this kind of arrangement can create. But when I see what is going on in the global financial safety net, last year during the spring meeting, the IMF and the G20 group, they called the regional financial arrangement to join them in this crisis to find a solution to the countries that are in need. So I may say that that's kind of completes the political reason why we should move forward.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And what about you, Mavis? What's your view? What would you advise? It's what you do as well.
Let me start by answering my president's question. Thank you, K.Y. So in terms of what are the potential threats to creating an African monetary fund and what is the stake of African countries in the continent in supporting it? I think there are, for me, two, potentially three major threats, yeah? Threat number one is leadership commitment, which I have spoken about, the extent to which leaders will buy into it and see the value of it. And that leadership threat is not just necessarily about poor leadership, but there's also an element of the risks associated with creating an AMF for 55 countries, some as big as like Nigeria, Kenya, and South Africa, some as small as Mali, Niger, Guinea. Okay, there are major risks. And unlike the European Union, where you saw a gradual entry point of countries, so countries had to meet minimum criteria to enter the AMF. If in Africa, the AU says we want, the AMF starts, and you start with a number of small countries signing up to it, the risk is you might not get the big countries signing up to it because they might not feel that they have the system has the protection that they need to be able to participate in the AMF. On the other side, if you have the big countries signing first, the small countries might feel that they've been crowded out. So there's a lot of technical work to be done. And I don't think we should underestimate how hard it will be to bring countries of different sizes different economic sizes, different capacities in terms of their central bank robustness and financial management. There's a lot to be worked out on the technical side. So the point I made earlier on around putting in place the necessary indicators and fiduciary structures to ensure that countries don't lose out because weaker countries have come on board. That is definitely a threat that we need to look at. And in terms of the stake in getting ready to support it, I actually fundamentally believe that if we get one or two large countries to buy into an AMF, it will move. If we get a South Africa or a Nigeria or a Ghana or an Egypt or a Kenya to join the list of countries that have already signed up to the union protocols, that is the thing that is going to shift it. Why should they do it? I think COVID has given all of us a really good impetus for why we should do it. Because even countries like Ghana, Ethiopia, Kenya, that seem to be doing well, are really struggling with liquidity. They are really struggling to stay on track with what they signed up to in terms of building their economies, deepening their growth, et cetera. So that would be the rationale. If I were to advise countries, what would I say? I would say when COVID happened, the world thought everything would go wrong for Africa. Actually, Africa came together and it's been really phenomenal. You know, having people like Dr. Kaburuka, our new female African WTO DG, and, you know, really great private sector leaders working together with Africa CDC, working together with the AU, working together with the regional blocs, has meant that we have navigated this better than we thought we were going to. I don't think it's going to be, it has been perfect. We've had weaknesses. There are systems challenges that needs to still be addressed, but we've navigated it a lot better than the world expected us to navigate it. And if you look at our biggest hiccup, I suspect if we could produce, we would have been fine too. If we could produce the vaccines on the continent, we would have been fine too. So if we've learned anything at all from COVID, when we come together, we are definitely stronger and we can achieve a lot and we can overcome some of these challenges. So the AMF is just another step to us coming together. And as they say, that old African proverb, you can break a single broom very easily, but when you bring all the sticks together into a broom, it is strong and it can sweep away all the problems even faster. So the AMF will help us sweep away our problems even faster than we are at the moment.
Excellent. That is that's a very appropriate way to finish this webinar. Thank you so much, Mavis, for joining us. Thank you, Hadiza, as well, for joining us and really sharing your insights on this issue. And I think all of us have really learned a great deal from the conversation. And I hope that this builds some great momentum. It's a starting point to be talking about it and, you know, to be really discussing this as a real possibility. And of course, just creating that extra complexity to be able to deal with the complex challenges that we have ahead of us and have experienced through COVID-19. Mavis, yes.
Hannah, one last pitch. I'd like to encourage everybody who has signed in today to really read the Development Imagined report. It was excellent. I learned a lot reading it, and I would really recommend that colleagues read it.
Thank you so much. I didn't even have to plug it myself. thank you so much. That's our flagship report on the 10 potential solutions to dealing with African debt financing issues. And that is that's available on our website, and also and this is one of the key recommendations and suggestions that we explore. Before we finish, let's do that final poll of our audience, just to see, you know, how does our audience feel? Are they persuaded? Do you think an African Monetary Fund? Let's go back to the is it a pipe dream? We better focus on other issues, or is it a necessity that we start working on, you know, accelerate the work on as quickly as possible? So let's give them a few seconds to let us know what they think. Okay, should we close it there? Let's see what the results are. Hopefully everyone voted quickly. Let's see, they're gonna come up. See what we've done. Oh, there we go. Wow, well, that's fantastic. What a result. 92% say that it's a necessity that we need to start working on as soon as possible. Fantastic. Okay, well, we know what we have to go and do. Thank you everyone for joining us. Thank you Mavis and Hadiza. Thank you also to the Development Reimagined team who've been working so hard to put this together. And please stay tuned. We have some more webinars coming up on the other solutions that we talk about in that report that Mavis just mentioned. So please stay tuned. Please follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn and elsewhere. And WeChat in China in order to keep up with what our next steps will be. And tomorrow we will be releasing a new video with a discussion with one of our African female leaders, not the DG at the WTO, but former finance minister for Guinea, Malada Kaba, and she will be sharing her insights on these sorts of issues as well. So please stay tuned for that and join us next time. Thank you again, Mavis and Hadiza, and we will be in touch. Bye-bye, everybody.